This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the UCSF Mini Medical School. Tonight's topic, we're going to be talking about heart failure, how to recognize and treat the weak heart. My name is Dr. John Muhammad, and I'm one of the cardiologists here, and I specialize in heart failure. So this is kind of an overview of the talks. We have three talks tonight, and hopefully by the end you're really able to comprehensively understand what is heart failure. So I'm going to start with what is heart failure, talking about some of the risk factors and some of the causes of heart failure. Then I'm going to talk about some of the diagnostic, how the patients present, what are the symptoms they have, and then talk about some of the diagnostic tests to diagnose heart failure. And then the second talk by Dr. Selby, my colleague, will talk about mostly the treatment of heart failure. And then my other colleague, Dr. Klein, will talk about the end-stage heart failure or late heart failure and other therapies for that population. So the objectives over the next 20 minutes, hopefully you'll be able to identify what is heart failure. We'll go over the different types of heart failure, how common is heart failure, what are the signs and symptoms, when should you go see a doctor, and then some of the diagnostic testing. So I think before we talk about heart failure, we really need to understand kind of like the normal heart and some of the functions of the heart, really to understand some of the pathologic process that can occur in heart failure. So you can see here, the heart is, you have basically four chambers in the heart. You have the top chambers here. These are the filling chambers. And then you have the bottom chambers. These are like the workhorse of the heart. These are contracting chambers. And it's divided into the right side and the left side. So you can see on the right side, it's blue. That means that the blood on the right side doesn't have any oxygen. And these chambers are separated by valves or doors, and they open and close. And so basically blood will come on the right side, and it'll go to the right ventricle, which is the pumping chamber on the right side, and get ejected out into what's called the pulmonary valve through the pulmonary arteries. It'll go to the lungs, and through the lungs it'll get oxygen. And then now the oxygenated blood is going to come back to the left side, and now it's red. And then it's going to go to the pumping chamber on the left side, which is called the left ventricle. And from there, it's going to get ejected out into what's called the aorta, which is the main blood vessel that ejects out of the heart. And then from there, it's going to go to all the vital organs in the body, the brain, the kidneys, the liver, the tissue, etc. So you can see that there's multiple areas in the heart which you can develop heart failure from. It could be a relaxation issue, or it could be a pumping issue, or it could be even a valve issue as well, too. And then the heart is a muscle. So the heart, the muscle needs nutrients and needs blood supply. And that's basically on this diagram here. You can see what's called, these are called the coronary arteries. These are the arteries or blood vessels that sit on top of the heart. And they basically provide nutrients to the heart muscle. And basically here on the, you have on the left side, you have what's called the left main, which is the main vessel that splits into two vessels here. And on the right, you have what's called the right coronary artery. So what is heart failure? So this slide or this picture nicely summarizes what heart failure is. And we're going to come back to this illustration at the end of the talk. So the definition of heart failure is heart failure or congestive heart failure is a condition in which the heart is unable to pump adequate blood flow to meet the needs of the body. We talked about in the last slide that the left side, the pumping chamber, has now oxygenated blood, and it provides nutrients to the rest of the body. And so that's what heart failure basically is. And there's different types of heart failure. So the way I kind of like to make it simplified is you have basically a relaxation problem. You have a stiff heart. It's not filling normally. We talked about the top chambers of the filling chambers. Or you have a pump issue, where the bottom chambers are the workhorse, and they have a problem with that. So this is what's called diastolic or relaxation heart failure. And you can see here the muscle is very thick, and as such, it doesn't fill with blood properly. And this results in a buildup of blood or congestion in the lungs, leading to heart failure and symptoms. On the other side here, you have what's called systolic or squeezing heart failure. This is when the pump is the problem. And as a result of the decreased pumping on the left side, blood again is going to build up back in the lungs and the tissues and cause symptoms and signs we see on exam. So there's a lot of other causes of heart failure too. This is what's called cardiomyopathies. Cardiomyopathy just means a disorder of the heart muscle. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but there's different causes. There's genetic causes. HCM is called hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, which is a thick heart. Sometimes you might see this if you have, like, if it's an athlete that dies suddenly, like Hank Gathers, who's a basketball player that died suddenly on the basketball court. He had hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. There's a genetic component to that. And then you have some of the acquired cardiomyopathies. It could be a virus. You have a virus developed leading to inflammation of the heart. Sometimes stress can lead to cardiomyopathy as well, too. Peripartum women, either in the last month of pregnancy or first few months after pregnancy, develop a cardiomyopathy or a weak heart or heart failure. Also, fast heartbeats can also develop into heart failure as well, too. So there's a lot of different causes. But the risk factors or causes for heart failure, well, we kind of expect, you know, a poor diet, smoking, etc. So the most common cause of heart failure is coronary artery disease or myocardial infarction or heart attacks, basically. And here, basically, we talked about, remember, before, you have these are the coronary arteries, the blood flow, the blood vessels that supply nutrients to the heart muscle. And here you can see basically a diagram of that artery, and you can see it's nice and smooth, and you have good blood flow. And here you can see a blocked artery. This could be due to diabetes or high cholesterol or high blood pressure over time. You have this plaque buildup basically here. And this leads to decreased blood flow to the heart muscle, and that can lead to heart failure. Myocardial infarction is basically means a heart attack. So sometimes when you have this plaque forming, that can lead to a heart attack. And this is the most common cause of heart failure. And here is basically an angiogram. An angiogram is basically an X-ray of the blood vessels in the heart. And so basically, this is done either through the groin or through the wrist, and basically you're going to pass a catheter up to the aorta, which is this main vessel here, and this is where the blood vessels, the coronary arteries, come off of, and then they inject dye, and they take a look at these vessels, and if you can appreciate here, you can see the vessel here. There's a little narrowing right here. This is the area of plaque that we're seeing basically in this diagram here. So there's other causes for heart failure as well, too. So we talked about coronary artery disease or blockages basically in the heart, heart attacks, high blood pressure. How does high blood pressure cause heart failure? The analogy I always like to think about is like you go to the gym, you work out, your muscle gets thicker, your biceps get bigger, hopefully. But over time, eventually, your heart is a muscle as well, too, and the heart sees all that high blood pressure over time. It can't sustain those high blood pressures, and then it just gives out, and you develop heart failure. Valvular heart disease basically means the different valves or different doors in the heart we talked about. If you have any abnormalities of those valves, that can lead to heart failure as well, too. Cardiomyopathy, we talked about those are disorders of the heart muscle. There's that list we talked about. Alcoholism can lead to heart failure as well, too. Drugs such as methamphetamine, which is definitely on the rise, can lead to heart failure. Thyroid diseases as well, too. Infection, we talked about, can cause an inflammation of the heart. Diabetes, a fast heartbeat. And then some other causes as well, too, is important to talk about. Obesity, smoking, and even high or low levels of blood counts, and then sleep apnea. So why is it important to recognize heart failure? Well, because more deaths from heart failure than all forms of cancer combined. So it's a pretty serious disease. And you can see here, over time, the number of cases is increasing, about 500,000 per year. And in 2037, they estimate to be about 10 million people that suffer with heart failure. So the incidence is definitely increasing. And why is that? We talked about the most common cause of heart failure is blockages in the arteries. And I think with our techniques on recognizing that and doing procedures and putting stents to open up those blockages, people are surviving heart attacks, and they're living longer, but they're living with heart failure. So you can see the cases of heart failure increasing. And here's basically showing that the prevalence is increasing, particularly people are living longer, so the population has changed as well, too. It's an older population as well, too. The mean age of diagnosis is about 74 years of age. And it's a very serious disease as well, too, very deadly. This is looking at cardiovascular or mortality or deaths from cardiovascular causes. Majority is still coronary artery disease or blockages in the arteries, but a 7% is related to heart failure, and that leads to about 300,000 deaths per year, so quite a large amount. And heart failure is very expensive. It leads to hospitalizations, and you can see here the total direct cost about $31 billion in 2012, and you can see it's going to skyrocket to $70 billion in 2030. Majority of this cost is related to hospital care and then nursing homes as well, too. So classifying heart failure, we'll talk about some of the terminology and staging. And I think this is an important slide I want to kind of spend some time on. So we have two ways of classifying heart failure. The first one is the New York Heart Associational Functional Class, which you see on the right side here. And that basically is a scale from 1 to 4. So basically this assesses a patient's symptoms, how limited they are from their heart failure. So class 1 is they're asymptomatic, they have no symptoms, and it goes all the way up to 4, which means they have resting shortness of breath. And this is very dynamic. So you could have a patient that you diagnose with heart failure, you put them on therapies, and they could be initially a class 3, and then they could become a 2. So it changes from time to time. And then a couple years ago, the ACC, which stands for the American College of Cardiology and the American Heart Association, came up with a staging system. And why did they come up with the staging system? Because they realized that there's risk factors for heart failure. They want to try to prevent the occurrence of heart failure. So they developed the staging system A through D. So let's kind of go through them. So A, these are patients that are high risk for heart failure but don't have any abnormalities on any testing. So we talked about patients who have high blood pressure, patients who have blockages in the arteries. So it clues in the primary care doctor who's seen these patients that this patient has diabetes, this patient has high blood pressure. I should be aware this patient has a higher chance of developing heart failure than somebody that does not have those conditions. So I should have a lower threshold of looking for heart failure for this patient. Stage B basically means that now they have abnormalities on some type of test, a diagnostic test, but they don't have any symptoms, which we'll go over. Stage C is when a lot of patients present. So now they come to the hospital with shortness of breath, and they have abnormality on testing. And then stage D is a late stage. So this slide basically kind of goes over the pathophysiology. I'll kind of simplify it basically, but I think it brings a good point that it starts with prevention, basically. So you have these preventable diseases, high blood pressure, blockages in the heart, valvular disease or abnormalities of those valves in the heart, obesity, diabetes, etc. So this is, you're trying to optimize these conditions. But over time, it can lead to abnormalities in the heart, leading to certain abnormal processes that occur, leading to development of some structural abnormality. It could be a stiff heart or a pumping problem. And that automatically now you're a stage B. So these patients have some abnormality in the heart, but they don't have any symptoms. And then over time, they can develop symptoms, and now they're stage C, and then it progresses. So with the staging system A through D, you can't go back and forth. You know, so basically what we're trying to do is at stage A, we're trying to really emphasize that reduction of high blood pressure, controlling blood pressure, diabetes, etc. This can hopefully slow this progression basically or halt it. So when should you go see the doctor? Hopefully it's not as obvious as this. So what are the signs and symptoms of heart failure? So we talked about you could either have a problem with relaxation or you can have a problem with pumping. But the net effect is the same, like you mentioned, is you get congestion in the lungs and in the body. So let's go through this. You'll be restless. Obviously, you have a lot of fluid buildup, so you're going to be anxious. You might have some confusion. Why is that? Because your heart, if it's not pumping adequately, you might not get good blood flow to the brain. Orthopnea basically means that at night, you'll be sleeping with extra pillows at night. You can't lie flat because when you lie flat, you get more congestion in the heart. So a lot of our patients say they can't sleep flat at night. They need to use pillows or sleep in a chair. Exertional dyspnea, when they walk, they get shortness of breath with limited distances. Fatigue could be a sign that the heart is very weak. And then as a result of congestion in the lungs. They'll have a cough. Usually it's a dry cough. It's worse at night. They might have some signs on exam when you listen to them with the stethoscope. They might have crackles, which is a certain sound we listen to, which represents fluid in the lungs. And their respiratory rate might be elevated. And something called paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea. This basically means that patients will wake up at night kind of gasping for air. Sometimes they'll say they need to go to a window to catch their breath. This is all a sign that they have a lot of congestion in the lungs and signs for heart failure. So how is a heart failure diagnosed? So first of all, you take a good medical history. And what is a good medical history? First of all, you want to look. I ask for questions about risk factors. Are they a diabetic? Do they have high blood pressure? Any drug history? To kind of clue you in, how high is your suspicion for this patient having heart failure? And then you do an exam, a physical exam. A lot of times, if many of you know someone with heart failure, we always look at the neck. And why are we doing that? So we have what's called the vein here, the internal jugular vein, which is like a dipstick that drains right into the heart. So you can imagine if a patient has backup of fluid, it's going to become very prominent, and that's what we're going to see on our exam. You can also have swelling of the feet as well, too, or the abdomen, and that's what you're seeing here, normal, and you can see swelling of this leg here. There's certain labs that we do as well, too. We do a CBC or a blood count. We want to see what the hemoglobin is, because if you have a high hemoglobin, that can lead to heart failure. A chemistry panel is going to look at your kidney function, because that might be affected by heart failure. We do a BNP, which is a blood test that's elevated when you have a lot of congestion, so it helps clue in whether this patient's likely to have heart failure or not. A TSH, which is the thyroid test. HIV iron studies, if a patient has iron overload. Too much iron in the body, that can lead to heart failure as well, too. And then there's some testing for specific populations. Iron, we talked about sleep studies, sleep apnea, which is increasing, is a very common cause for heart failure and can be potentially treated if you have a patient on CPAP or certain therapy for sleep apnea. There's certain proteins that deposit in the heart. There's certain testing we can do for that as well, too. And then there's some heart failures that's genetic, so there can be genetic screen can be done as well, too.
What's
BNP? So BNP is actually a blood test that when the heart is stretched or congested, it will go up. So you could have a patient that – so the troubling is when your patient comes, let's say, to emergency room, and you're trying to – patient's shortness of breath. You're trying to figure, is it from the heart or is it from the lungs? And sometimes you can use a BNP as a blood test to see if it's from the heart versus the lungs. So that kind of differentiates between the two.
What does it stand for, BNP?
So it's natriuretic peptide, basic natriuretic peptide, yeah. So EKG as well, too, can be a clue in that there's something wrong with the heart. So that could be a first sign as well, too. Chest x-ray. So this is, here's your lungs basically here, and this is the heart silhouette here. You can see the lungs are clear. They're aerated. This is a patient with heart failure. So I don't know if you can appreciate here, but if you look at the size here versus here, this heart is very enlarged, and you can see the lungs. This is all filled with fluid. That's why it has that appearance of kind of the whitest appearance, which is this is all air. And this is all filled with fluid. And really the gold standard is an echocardiogram. This is an ultrasound. And if you remember the anatomy pictures, we talked about you have the pumping chambers and you have the filling chambers. So we'll just focus on the pumping chambers here. This is the left side. This is the right side. You can appreciate here that this left side here is nicely coming in. It's pumping nice and normal. And here's a patient with heart failure. This is what's called systolic heart failure. You can see the chamber here is quite enlarged compared to here. And you can see the function, the amount that is coming in is reduced. So this patient has systolic heart failure. So the echo is really the gold standard. It can tell us a lot of information. It can tell us the pumping ability of the heart. And also you can see the valves here. We talked about those doors that separate the different chambers. You can also see if there's any leakage of this valve as well, too. So the echo is a key indicator for diagnosing heart failure. It'll tell you what's called an ejection fraction, which is the amount of blood that's pumped out of your heart with each heartbeat. It's important to evaluate cardiac function. It also reflects the strength of the ventricular contraction or the left ventricle contracting. Sometimes imaging is done as well, too, for certain conditions. We said heart failure, there's many different causes. Some causes are due to a protein deposit, and you can do a cardiac MRI to look for that, and also nuclear imaging as well, too. And some type of workup for looking for blockage of the heart has to be done, because we talked that's the most common cause. So many times patients will undergo a catheterization where we actually inject dye to look at the blood vessels and making sure there's no abnormalities. Because theoretically, if there's any abnormalities, if you're able to restore the blood flow, now you have more nutrients to the heart muscle, and the heart muscle can actually improve. So this is a reversible cause, potentially, of heart failure. So in summary, it came back to this picture again. So what is heart failure? It's a disorder of the heart. Prevention is key. We talked about the certain risk factors that you have a higher chance of having heart failure. The signs and symptoms are related to congestion or decreased output. And if you can see here on the slide, this is kind of nicely illustrated. You can see this heart here is enlarged. He's having a lot of trouble breathing here. As you can see, some sweat coming down his brow. So this nicely summarizes really what patients feel like when they have heart failure and kind of some of the patterns that they see. So with that, we'll continue on to the next talk. And we'll have questions at the end. Okay.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. My name is Vance Elby. I'm also part of the Advanced Heart Failure Program, along with Dr. John Muhammad. I have a little bit of a broad topic to talk about today. It's basically treatment of heart failure. And we're really going to be focusing on what he referred to as the stage C patients, the patients who have developed symptomatic heart failure, whether it be due to systolic dysfunction or diastolic dysfunction. So I'm going to try to go over a fair number of topics because there's a lot of different ways we treat heart failure. And then if there are any questions, like he just said, we'll have time at the end. So we'll first talk about the goals of heart failure treatment. It's very important to set goals and understand your priorities, whether you're the patient or the treating physician. You need to know what you're trying to accomplish. Then we'll get into some of the specific things. So we often start with lifestyle modification, whether that be diet, exercise, whatever it is that they can help patients feel better and hopefully do better. Then we'll get on to medical therapy for heart failure. There are about five or six different types of medications we'll go over. And then we'll talk about some devices for patients who still have symptoms despite the best medications. So, okay, what are the goals of treatment if you're a patient with heart failure or a provider who's treating it? Well, the first thing is to relieve symptoms. You just heard all the different symptoms of heart failure, whether it's shortness of breath, swelling, fatigue, what have you. You know, the symptoms are broad, and we want to make patients feel better. It's a condition that really impacts the quality of life for our patients, and we have some medications that can be very effective for relieving those symptoms. Second is to slow disease progression. So you saw some echoes of some weak hearts, some hearts that are starting to get big and dilated over time. We like to reverse and maybe even improve that function with medications, and we do have a few that are capable of that. We want to reduce hospitalizations and emergency room visits. Hospitalizations are considered kind of a bad sign in heart failure and a sign that a patient's not doing as well as they should be. So you see a lot of effort going into keeping patients out of the hospital as much as possible. And finally, ideally, we have medications that will prolong life and with proven ability to make people live longer compared to patients who don't get that medication. That's usually one of our biggest goals as providers, is to prolong life. And for most patients, I'd say that's one of their biggest goals. There are some patients who really want to focus on symptom relief more than life prolongation. And it's very important to just have that discussion and reach an understanding of what you're trying to do with your treatment. Okay. So the first thing when you have a patient with heart failure in terms of treating it is there some underlying cause I can fix? And you just saw a few of them. So coronary artery disease, we always look for this in just about every patient with heart failure, partly because if you find it, you can often fix it. So the two acronyms in there are CABG, coronary artery bypass graft surgery, and then PCI is percutaneous coronary intervention, also known as stents. And like Dr. John Muhammad said, if you open up the blocked arteries and restore blood flow to the heart, you can oftentimes improve the function, improve symptoms, and patients will do better overall. Hypertension is a common cause of heart failure, so we obviously try to treat that as best we can in anyone with heart failure. And we do that through both medications and diet, as we'll get to. valvular heart disease. So you may have heard of conditions like aortic stenosis, mitral regurgitation. They're valves that are either not opening properly or not closing properly, and so they leak. Those are common causes of heart failure, and oftentimes, if detected early enough, you can repair or replace the diseased valve, and the heart will get better. Some patients are born with heart defects. We call that congenital heart disease. And sometimes you can repair those surgically or through catheters that go into veins and arteries in the body. And fixing those will often help the heart function if that's the cause. And then we also want to just aggressively treat any condition that might be contributing or causing the heart failure. So diabetes, anemia, sleep apnea. It's really important to aggressively control these sorts of comorbidities. So now we're going to get on to other specific treatments for heart failure itself. But as we do, I want you to just keep this this in mind. So like I said, causes of hospitalization for heart failure is something we really try to avoid. We consider it a bad outcome when a patient is hospitalized. And this is a list of the most common causes. So we're going to talk about diet. We can often find dietary triggers to, in this study, almost a quarter of all heart failure hospitalizations. Patients not taking their medications as prescribed, another big cause. So we'll talk about the medications to take. Failure to seek care. So I'm going to go over some of the symptoms and signs that you need to contact medical therapy. And then inappropriate therapy, which is often on the part of the prescribing physician or nurse or whoever's taking care of the patient. And so we'll go over some of the medications we use. So by the end, we'll have addressed a lot of the really the main causes to bad outcomes in patients with heart failure. So first, we'll start with diet. Some of this stuff is very targeted toward patients with heart failure. I know many in the room don't have heart failure, but actually a lot of these things are good to keep in mind in general. Sodium is kind of one of mine and a lot of cardiologists' biggest pet peeves. In heart failure, it just wreaks havoc on the body. It really causes you to retain extra fluid, leading to that swelling, whether it be in the lungs, the legs, whatever. It also increases the blood pressure, which makes the heart have to work harder. So it's really just oftentimes the bane of our existence. And I can't tell you how many times a patient will come into the clinic or the emergency department totally swollen with fluid, and then you find it was, you know, either some chicken wings or a can of soup or something that they ate a day or two ago and just started retaining fluid ever since then. That said, it's not just heart failure patients, especially if you have high blood pressure, but even just the general population, there's some evidence coming out that just higher sodium diets are linked to death in just broad populations, whether it be from stroke or heart disease or something. There's a good correlation now between dietary sodium intake and bad outcomes. So whether or not you have heart failure, you should pay attention and try to incorporate these as best as you can. 2,000 milligrams a day is kind of the rough consensus opinion. Different societies will have different recommendations, but I think it's not impossibly strict. You know, if you tell a patient eat 500 milligrams of sodium a day, there's no way they can do it. But I think it kind of finds a acceptable balance. One teaspoon of salt is 2,300 milligrams of sodium. So this isn't a lot of salt that I'm saying you should be eating. So something to keep in mind. So it depends on the chips, but my guess would be at least 400 milligrams or so. Chips are a great source of salt, and I mean that in a bad way, of course. But we'll talk about label reading, which is kind of the most important skill you could take for when it comes to diet. A lot of patients say cutting down on salt is really hard at first, but eventually you kind of get used to it. Your taste buds sort of adapt to the lower salt foods. Some patients even say they start to appreciate new flavors that they used to just drown out with salt. So it is doable. Watching your fluid intake. And that's really something that heart failure patients can discuss with their doctors in terms of exactly how much they take. But it kind of makes sense that if you drink 6 liters of fluid, you're more likely to build it up in the heart, in the lungs or in your legs or your belly or wherever. So we try to watch that. I've got to drive home the point on sodium a little bit. Packaged foods are just a horrendous source of sodium. So whether that be chips or a pack of noodles or a can of soup, they're just all full of sodium. So cooking for yourself as much as you can, especially if you have heart failure, it's really important to get into it. I'll show you some labels in a second. Eating fresh fruits and vegetables, even eating just fresh meat, it's much, much better than packaged. Don't use a salt shaker. Try using herbs and spices whenever you can to cook. Condiments, especially things like soy sauce or some of the other things you see in restaurants, can really be sources of sodium. There are a lot of low-salt cookbooks out there. This is one from the American Heart Association. But if you just Google low-salt cooking, there are lots of things that come up, and you can find lists of ways to cut salt out of your diet. And then you got to learn how to read labels. So this is from a can of soup. So for one cup, 1,080 milligrams of sodium. So you've taken about half your daily intake with just one small can of soup. So that's what I mean by packaged foods. And this is another slide that doesn't come out great, but it says that 77% of the sodium in food is from the processing. So, you know, they take low-salt natural ingredients, package it into a can of soup or what have you, and that's where it gets most of its sodium. And so that leads to my recommendation of cooking on your own as much as possible, where you know exactly how much sodium is going in and you're starting with fresh ingredients. So lifestyle modifications. You'll see recommendations of usually about 30 to 45 minutes a day. That can be tough for a heart failure patient who's really limited. But it's a good goal to strive for 5 days a week. Especially if you have heart disease, it's important to talk to your doctor first. Just make sure what you're doing is acceptable and that you're not pushing yourself too hard. And then for those cardiac patients out there anyone who has friends or family who have heart disease, I'd really make a plug to consider cardiac rehabilitation. I'm a huge fan of it. It's basically this is kind of an idealized picture of what goes on at cardiac rehab, where you're exercising, but you're constantly monitored. You're being given a very specific exercise regimen catered to your disease. And you know, I find a lot of patients come to me and say, well, I'm really scared to exercise because I don't want to overdo it. I don't want to trigger a heart attack. I don't want to trigger a dangerous rhythm. And this is a nice way to alleviate that and let them sort of build up their exercise while constantly monitored. So if you have heart disease, talk to your doctor about cardiac rehab. So other good lifestyle modifications, and here's where we get really specific things for people with heart failure. So we tell them, check your weight every morning. Increase in weight is a suggestion that you're starting to retain fluid, and so we tell patients to really watch out for that closely and to call their doctor if they start to gain any weight. I really like to tell people what their dry weight is, meaning when you don't have extra fluid, this is your weight, this is where I want you to be. If you gain 3 pounds above that, call the office, and we'll talk about what you can do. Making sure you take meds regularly. You might remember that medication non-adherence was about 20% of the contributors to hospitalizations. And then keeping track of symptoms. So again, another common cause from that graph I showed at the beginning was patients not seeking care when appropriate. So if you're swelling up more, if you're more short of breath, if you can't sleep flat, any of these things. I think you already saw a slide very similar to this, but you know, swelling, coughing, trouble breathing, chest pain, confusion, seek medical care because that's a sign that something's going wrong and you want to address it quickly. Other little things, just good overall healthy diet, losing weight if you're obese, quitting smoking, you know, all this stuff just helps the whole cardiovascular system and makes the body work more efficiently. Getting your vaccinations, and then alcohol in moderation. So alcohol increases the blood pressure. It can predispose you to retaining fluid, so really avoiding it in excess. Alcohol is also a cause of heart failure in some patients, and if that's the case, then we usually recommend completely avoiding it so that the heart can heal up. Okay, so on to medical therapy. So what are the goals of medical therapy? Well, we want to get rid of excess water and prevent patients from getting too swollen and uncomfortable. We like to use vasodilators. These are medications that relax the blood vessels. So Dr. John Muhammad talked about how in high blood pressure, you really increase the work the heart has to do. Well, if you relax those blood vessels, then you decrease the work the heart has to do, and it can work more efficiently. As Dr. John Muhammad showed in a previous slide, there are a lot of hormones produced in heart failure that lead to some of the problems, whether it be thickening of the heart or dilation and weakening of the heart. So we have some medications that can target those hormones that the heart produces in response to heart failure, and those can really be effective for reversing or at least slowing down the progression. And then finally, there are some medications that just help the heart squeeze better. So we're going to do about one slide per class of medication, and these are kind of complicated medications, so I'll try to just hit the highlights. Diuretics are a medication that almost every heart failure patient ends up on, and it's often the first thing they get put on. Diuretics are medications that help you get rid of fluid. So they block various areas in the kidneys and increase the amount of water that's secreted. Some of the most common ones are Lasix, Bumex, Diuril. And one thing I really like to do is get a patient on them, but then also tell them that they can adjust it as needed. So say you weigh yourself one day and your weight's up 3 pounds and maybe you're a little more swollen. You can take an extra dose of Lasix that day, or you can call my office and we'll tell you to take it. But it's nice to kind of just adjust it to keep patients at that dry weight as best as possible. Other tips, just if you have heart failure, so sometimes people stop taking their evening dose because it keeps them up all night going to the bathroom. You can take it early in the afternoon and you won't have that problem. So these are the medical therapies that are shown to improve harder outcomes in patients. And by that, I mean they either reduce hospitalizations, improve mortality, or both. So you'll see for systolic heart failure, we have a lot of different classes, and I'll get to them. Unfortunately, for diastolic heart failure, and I also use this acronym here, HFpEF, heart failure with preserved ejection fraction, meaning that ejection fraction, which is the amount the heart squeezes, is still normal. There's really no therapy that's clearly proven to reduce mortality. So just bear in mind, all of these are specifically for systolic heart failure, people with reduced ejection fractions. And I'm going to go through in the order that they were kind of discovered to be beneficial. ACE inhibitors are kind of the cornerstone of good medical management for systolic heart failure. We've known that for a long time now. I always try to get my patients on them. These are medications that end in pril. So you'll hear about lisinopril, enalapril, captopril, benazepril, ramipril. They all sound like that. They're blood pressure medications, so they do relax the blood vessels, but they also block the production of some of these hormones that we talked about that lead to thickening and weakening and eventually failure of the ventricle. So they kind of target that what we call the neurohormonal. So they're hormones that are produced that caused a lot of the damage of heart failure. We know from many large trials now that they improve heart function, so they can improve the ejection fraction. They can make people feel better, keep them out of the hospital, and improve survival. So I'm not going to show a lot of graphs from particular trials because I don't think there's really time to go into all the results. But this is just one of the early trials of an ACE inhibitor. So they tested enalapril. You don't see it as much these days, but it's one of the ACE inhibitors versus placebo. So what we have here is basically death. So from zero to, it goes up to 80% of all the patients dead in the study and over time. And you see that patients who are in enalapril, far fewer at the end of the study, about 20% fewer are dead than the patients who are in the placebo group. So it doesn't completely fix the problem. You know, we still have about 40% of patients dying at a year, which is a lot, but it's much better than the placebo. So this is, what's that?
ACE, what is ACE?
ACE, it stands for angiotensin-converting enzyme. It's basically the enzyme, one of the enzymes in the pathway that leads to these hormones that then cause damage to the heart. Angiotensin-converting enzyme. And these medications inhibit that enzyme, so prevent it from doing breaking down the hormones. There's also a class of medications called ARBs, angiotensin receptor blockers. We usually end up using those in patients who, for some reason, can't take ACE inhibitors.
What would be the reason?
So a cough is actually the most common. I'd say the most common side effect of ACE inhibitors is cough. And sometimes patients who develop it with an ACE inhibitor will then do fine on the angiotensin receptor blocker. And they're good medications. We just don't have as robust of data supporting them. And we like to think that ACE inhibitors are really the ideal medication for heart failure. Other things, sometimes in patients with kidney disease or high potassium, you also have to be careful with the ACE inhibitor. Also, if the blood pressure is low, that ends up being something that really limits our ability to use these medications because, like I said, they do relax the blood vessels and therefore lower blood pressure. Okay, so the next class of medications that was discovered for systolic heart failure is called beta blockers. The ones that we specifically like in heart failure, Coreg or carvedilol, toprol or metoprolol, and bisoprolol. There are others, so if you or someone you know has heart failure and they're not on one of these three, you might want to ask if they can be changed or why they're not on them. They have a couple effects. They do decrease what are called catecholamines, which are, again, one of these hormones that are produced in response to heart failure. It kind of like revs up the sympathetic nervous system, and beta blockers undo that and some of the untoward effects of it. They also slow the heart rate. They are also blood pressure medications. So again, sometimes you'll be limited with these by issues with blood pressure. We know, again, from very large, very good trials, they improve heart function, reduce hospitalizations, and increase survival in heart failure with systolic dysfunction. Whether beta blockers or ACE inhibitors is better, it's hard to say. ACE inhibitors kind of were discovered first, so usually we get patients on some ACE inhibitor, and then this is almost always the second drug we add. The third big discovery and the third kind of step forward in the medical management of heart failure was aldosterone antagonists. Again, this is actually a diuretic, but one of its effects is to inhibit the action of a hormone called aldosterone, which is one of the key hormones in this whole hormonal cascade that causes the damage in heart failure. Again, it's for heart failure with systolic dysfunction. The two meds, spironolactone and eplerenone, that are approved. And these really, even more than the ACE inhibitors, can be risky in people with bad kidney disease or high potassium. So, if you have really bad kidney disease or really high potassium levels, you probably shouldn't be on them in the first place. But if you do get started on them, it's really important to monitor the levels of potassium and kidney function in the blood, because if potassium gets too high, it can be a really dangerous situation. The last class of medications I'm going to talk about is hydralazine and nitrates. So this is just a combination of two different medications that both relax the blood vessels. So it lets the heart beat more efficiently. One relaxes the arteries, one relaxes the veins. This is a really interesting combination of medications because it was specifically shown to benefit African-American patients. We don't usually do clinical trials looking at specific racial groups, but there was some kind of genetic and scientific evidence to suggest they may particularly benefit from it. So they studied this combination of patients who, of note, were already taking an ACE inhibitor and many times some of the other medications I talked about. And with this medication added, the combination was shown to improve symptoms and survival in these patients. So it's a good option for African-American patients with heart failure due to systolic dysfunction who are already on good medical therapy for heart failure. If they still have blood pressure room left, we will tend to add this class of medications. It's one of the few medications we use that's got a race-based indication. So digoxin or digitalis is one of the oldest heart failure medications. It originally was identified in the foxglove plant, which you see here. And basically, it just helps the heart squeeze stronger. It acts on one of the ion channels in the heart membrane and leads to increased levels of ATP, which is sort of the fuel the heart needs to contract. And so it increases contractions. The main thing to know about it is it reduces symptoms. It probably helps keep people out of the hospital, but it has no effect on survival. So the other four classes of medications we went over all improve survival. Digoxin has not been shown to. It also requires monitoring of levels, and if the levels get too high, it can become dangerous, oftentimes causing the heart to beat irregularly and sometimes in dangerous ways. So it can be great for some patients as long as you just are careful with your selection and monitor closely. Okay, medical therapy of diastolic heart failure. So like I said, nothing's been shown to improve survival. There was one study that showed the aldosterone antagonist, so spironolactone and eplerenone, may have some benefit, but they're not going to gain FDA approval for diastolic heart failure yet. So we end up doing things like controlling blood pressure, treating contributing factors, and then diuretics to keep the fluid off. There are new medications that are in clinical trials, and hopefully we'll sometime soon see beneficial medications for diastolic heart failure. You may hear about a couple of new medications. LCZ-696, as far as I know, it still doesn't have a name and it's not approved yet, but I already have patients asking about this. It combines an ACE inhibitor, so it's actually that medication enalapril we talked about, with another hormonal blocker called a neprilysin inhibitor. So it just targets yet another pathway. They did a big trial where they compared it to enalapril alone and found that it improved outcomes in systolic heart failure. The other medication that was just recently approved is called ivabradine, and it slows the heart rate in patients ideally who are already on beta blockers. And that can improve outcomes in a select group of patients who still need more heart rate lowering. Last two things I want to talk about, implantable cardioverter defibrillators. So this looks like a pacemaker. It sits in the chest wall, and it has wires that come to the heart. So the idea is that patients with weak hearts, and again, this is systolic heart failure, they're at risk for ventricular tachycardia or other ventricular arrhythmias. Here you see the heart's beating nice and normally, and then it goes into this kind of wide, fast rhythm. that can be fatal. So the ICD shocks the heart out of it. It detects that rhythm, delivers a shock, and is quite effective for restoring a normal rhythm. We know that in patients with an ejection fraction less than 35%, it does save lives and improve survival. A couple things to note. It's important that you are already on good medical therapy and reassess the ejection fraction. So you want poor cardiac function despite aggressive medications. The other thing to know that I'm not sure patients always totally understand is that it has no effect on your symptoms or quality of life. It's just purely there in case you go into this rhythm to shock you out of it and keep you alive. But day to day, it's not going to make you feel any better. And then there's cardiac resynchronization therapy. This is also called biventricular pacemakers. So in some patients, the heart, which usually squeezes in unison, so you have both ventricles just squeezing like that with every beat. In some patients, as the heart dilates, the heart stops doing that. So you might get the lateral part of the heart squeezing before the septum or what have you. And what you end up with is this really wide pattern on the EKG tracing. So a nice normal beat produces a narrow signal like this, but some diseased hearts get these wider complexes. So cardiac resynchronization therapy puts one pacemaker lead in the right ventricle here, and then another one into something called the coronary sinus, which effectively leads it to the left ventricle. So you get pacemakers that can pace at the exact same time from opposite sides of the heart and really get the whole heart to squeeze together. It can improve symptoms, it can reduce hospitalizations, and improves quality of life. Often it's combined with the defibrillator. So you might have something that both does this resynchronization, but then also can shock the heart if it goes into a dangerous rhythm. So this is just a chart I found from another heart failure presentation that basically outlines our approach. You start with diuretics to get rid of extra fluid. We always try to get people on an ACE inhibitor, then a beta blocker, then that aldosterone antagonist. If they're still symptomatic, meaning they're still limited in what they can do, we'll think about either cardiac resynchronization therapy, or if they don't have that widening, then we might still do an implantable defibrillator. If they're African-American, we'll think about hydralazine and nitrates. And then if they're still symptomatic with all that, digoxin is an option to just make people feel better, maybe keep them out of the hospital, but does not prolong mortality. So, to summarize, it's always important to identify and treat underlying causes of heart failure. Successful management of heart failure starts with lifestyle modification. We have many medications to treat heart failure due to systolic dysfunction, and hopefully soon we'll start to see medications to treat diastolic heart failure as well. And then devices such as implantable cardioverter defibrillators or cardiac resynchronization therapy may be an option for certain groups of heart failure patients. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Liviu Klein, one of the other cardiologists in the group. And I'm going to take you to the end stage part of heart failure. So as Dr. John Muhammad and Dr. Selby previously presented, you have different options for stage C or symptomatic heart failure. And sometimes, despite all these good medications that we have, despite all these devices, the heart still progresses to get weaker and weaker. In which case, patients end up in end-stage heart failure. So what is really the definition of end-stage or advanced heart failure? Well, somebody that has symptoms for a long, long time with minimal exertion. We call that class 4, if you remember the chart with the New York Heart Association. So really at rest or just, walk in the bathroom, they get short of breath, and, they're really, really tired. Usually these patients come to the hospital at least twice or three times a year. With fluid overload, they get diarrhea, they go home, and again, they come back. Patients have been able to take medications, but now suddenly their blood pressure is too low or they have kidney failure because of poor pump function, so we have to stop the good medications that kept the heart working. So these are all signs of advanced heart failure. Sometimes we need the medications through IV to keep the patients out of the hospital. So these are all, bad signs, meaning that the heart is failing. I just want to show a graph from one of the studies was done about 10 years ago, looking at 100,000 patients that came to the hospital, and they looked how many times they were hospitalized. And if you see here, in general, the patients that were hospitalized, about 60% actually were hospitalized multiple times. And what they have here is survival. So after hospitalization for heart failure, how long did you live afterwards? So if you just been hospitalized once, you know, the one-year mortality is about 50%, so still pretty high. But if you came to the hospital multiple times, your mortality was really, really high. So people that were hospitalized more than three times, almost 80% of the patients were dead within a year. We don't really think about heart failure, you know, that it's such a poor prognosis, especially in the end stage. And, you know, people are really worried about cancers. A lot of patients know that, you know, cancers have relatively poor prognosis. But if you compare the absolute worst cancer that people can have, which is stage 4 small cell lung cancer, the prognosis is really similar to end-stage heart failure. So it is a very, very debilitating disease. We have about 80,000 people dying from heart failure every year from progressive heart failure. So if you look at all the cardiovascular mortality, half of the people die from a heart attack or ventricular fibrillation, the infections, and about 7 to 10% die from heart failure. Again, about 80,000 or so in the United States. So if you look at sort of the overall U.S. population, how many patients we're talking about affected by end-stage heart failure. So we think, you know, we have about 5 million patients that have heart failure. And as we've previously heard, it could be diastolic, so heart failure due to a very stiff heart, or systolic heart failure due to a weak heart. And in these patients, about a third are class 1, so minimally symptomatic. About a third are class 2, and a third are class 3 and 4. So I think if we're pulling out all these, you know, subgroups of patients, we probably have about 80,000 patients that are class 4 and, you know, 80 years of age or younger. So a lot of these patients die unless we have, you know, another therapy. And, you know, obviously, the best therapy that we have for heart failure is heart transplant. So this is just a normal heart that one of our surgeons took a picture before the transplant, and this is what came out. So you can appreciate, you know, the heart that the patient had, how much bigger, it was probably three times bigger and thicker than the normal heart. So heart transplant is the treatment of choice for patients. Actually, survival after heart transplant is excellent. The mean survival is about 14 years, and we have a graph here from the International Society of Heart and Lung Transplantation looking at patients starting 1981 when we started to do the first successful heart transplant. And you can see over time the survival has improved. So the most recent decade, again, the average survival is about 13 years, and people get fairly normal quality of life. We're actually proud at UCSF to have a better survival than the national average. So these are our data at 1 month, 1 year, and 3 years. And UCSF, it's here in the darker blue column. Again, we are better than national average, so we're very proud of that. What do patients do after a heart transplantation? Well, they actually go back to normal lives. And the best story I am telling patients, you know, there's a famous surgeon in England called Magdi Yacoub, a very famous cardiac surgeon, and he visited one of his patients before the transplantation. And the, you know, patient asked, well, if I receive a transplant, can I go back to my regular job and do what I did before? And he's like, no problem. He never asked the patient what his job was. He was actually a soccer player. So he ended up going back and play soccer for 10 years professionally in England after the transplant. So if you look at, you know, the data again from the ISHLT, in red are patients that have no limitations. So the majority of patients, actually 90%, have absolutely no limitations in terms of their regular physical activity after heart transplantation. And it's actually carried over at, even at 5 years. So it's not just a short-term benefit, it's a long-term benefit. And probably about 10% have some limitation. Comparing to somebody that was class 4 before, they barely could walk the bathroom, now we have someone that's pretty normal again. So it's pretty remarkable. What about rehospitalization? Well, initially after heart transplantation the first year, some people get hospitalized because of either infections or rejections or some other things related to surgery. But still the vast majority, about 50%, do not get hospitalized. And as they move forward from the transplant, things get much easier. And again, if you look at about 5 years, the vast majority are staying out of the hospital and just a very small number of patients come in for different reasons. You do have to take medications. A lot of the patients ask, well, if I get a heart transplant, do I have to take medications? Yes, unfortunately, you do. There are different medications, mainly try to fool the immune system to not reject, you know, the new heart. So a lot of immunosuppressive medications. And there's different combinations of these medications depending on the case and the center, but everybody's at least on two or three immunosuppressive medications. Unfortunately, there's no free lunch, so these medications do have side effects. Some of them can increase the blood pressure, so pretty much everyone will develop high blood pressure after heart transplantation. It's almost a given. Some patients develop kidney dysfunction because you can have a toxic effect of the medications, especially taken after 5 or 10 years on the kidney function. Fortunately, very few patients end up on dialysis or needing a kidney transplant, less than 5%. So majority have some kidney dysfunction, which we can just manage with medications. A lot of patients develop high cholesterol if they haven't had prior high cholesterol. About a third of the patients develop diabetes, mainly due to the prednisone, the steroids that we use initially, and also some of the other medication that we use long-term. Again, usually it's managed by diet and medications. And something that's very specific to the heart transplantation is called cardiac vasculopathy. It's essentially blockage that occurs in the blood vessels of the heart as a result of chronic rejection. So if you remember, prior to having heart failure, patients can get coronary artery disease where you have cholesterol blocking the arteries and causing heart attacks. This is a similar process. It's a different mechanism, but a similar process where, you know, the blockage occurs in the vessels of the heart. And about half of the patients after, you know, 5 to 10 years develop that. And we have, you know, become smarter, and we have new medications to try to prevent that, and we have new tests that we do after transplantation to foresee who will develop this type of blockage and try to prevent it. What is it, you know, to live with a heart transplantation? Well, it is a it is an enterprise, so people do have to change their, you know, lifestyle and adjust their lifestyle to deal with all these other secondary issues that they have to take care of. So they do require blood tests. Initially, it's 3 times a week, and then it becomes weekly, every 2 weeks, every month, and then every few months. You have to make sure that you have a very, you know, rigorous infectious disease protocol because you're immunosuppressed, so patients are at risk for developing infections. So you have to wear a mask when you go in public or when you fly a plane. You know, you have to really be careful about hygiene and then, you know, exposure to other things. And you have to take some antibiotics initially. As I mentioned, some patients do get diabetes, so it's very important to control their diabetes so they don't develop complications in the long term. The same thing with the kidney function, very important to monitor their kidney function. Patients are exposed to medications that can cause, especially skin cancer, so dermatologists are usually becoming their best friend. They see them every 6 months to make sure that they do not develop skin cancer. Very important nutrition. A lot of the patients are underweight before they go under heart transplantation because they are very, very sick, that they cannot eat. Once they get a transplant, you know, their appetite comes back. The prednisone on top of that increases the appetite. So a lot of patients get, you know, gain weight very rapidly, especially after transplantation. And unfortunately, then become lazy, and then afterwards they keep the weight on instead of dropping it. Very important to keep their screening and health maintenance to prevent regular things that can happen. And a lot of the patients suffer from depression coming in into transplant because they've been sick for so long. So it's important to treat the depression afterwards and make sure that they are able to, you know, to enjoy their life. So again, heart transplantation is, you know, the best solution for heart failure patients. Unfortunately, there's just not enough hearts to go around. So if we look over the last 20 years of how many heart transplants have been done in the world, we see about, you know, 4,000 or so. The green is the U.S. So we're probably capped at about 2,200 adult heart transplants for the last 25 years or so. And as you remember, I just said that about 80,000 patients die every year from heart failure. So we're way, way underserved in that regard. So fortunately, not a lot of patients are able to get heart transplantation. In fact, last year, we did about 2,100 heart transplants, and less than 25% were done in adults over age 65. If you remember what Dr. John Muhammad showed in the beginning, the average age when people are diagnosed with heart failure is 74. So the vast majority of these patients are actually not candidates for heart transplantation because of, you know, the lack of organs. Fortunately, we have a new solution in the last 15 years or so. We have ventricular assist devices or artificial heart pumps. So these devices, you can just take them off the shelf and you can implant them in patients. And I'll show you some data suggesting that perhaps this is the way to the future. So we have these four types of devices. The first generation are pulsatile devices. They were done in about 2000 or so about 15 years ago. Then we moved over to the continuous axial flow, smaller devices, and then the third generation where we are right now, and then there's a total artificial heart for a very small subset of patients. The two main devices that we use nowadays that are FDA approved are HeartMate 2 and HVAD. I just want to show you a few diagrams. So this is a scheme of one of the devices, a first generation device. You can see how big it is. It weighed about 5 pounds. It had to go into the abdomen and then connect it to the tubes to the heart. And then you have two valves that, and the pusher plate that will get the blood moving throughout, you know, the pump and then back to the body. The second generation, the axial flow, is actually much, much smaller. It still has to go in the abdomen, but weighs only about a pound or so. So vast improvement compared to the first generation. And these are the actual pictures. You can see the first generation device and the second generation. So the pump, you know, it's much, much smaller now. So the second generation pump we've been using for about 10 years. So this was 15 years ago. This is 10 years or so. And now we're using the third generation pumps, which are really, really small. And these pumps are implanted straight into the heart. They don't need to go into the abdomen. The blood comes perpendicularly into the pump and then gets out from the pump. And this is how small they are. They're literally, you can hold them in the palm of your hand. They're really, really small. So if you just look at how the pumps are connected, again, the first generation pump was put in the abdomen, had a big tube coming from the heart, and then a big tube going to the aorta to get the blood back into the body. Then you have a drive line, which is an electrical connector coming through the skin to a battery pack that the patients have to carry to power the pump. And you had a pusher plate that was just pushing the blood around. They had air vents. They were very noisy. You could just hear it from the outside the room when somebody had one of these pumps. And again, it was a great development because until then, the patients that were waiting for transplant, they had to wait in the hospital for 3, 4, 5 months tied in the ICU bed. Now, for the first time, people could go home and wait for a heart transplant, you know, to become available at home. Unfortunately, very high infection rate because they are so big. And then usually after about 18 months, you have to replace them, so you have another surgery. And I just want to show an X-ray to just visualize how big this is. So this is one of my former patients from Chicago, and I lived there. He was a patient from Michigan. He was 6'5 and 350 pounds, so big guy. And you can see the pump, it's almost as big as he is. So there's no way this pump could go in women. And, in fact, no women actually were able to get this pump because it's so big, or someone from, you know, a smaller body frame. Moving to the second generation, again, they're much, much smaller, maybe about 10 inches or so. And they have mechanical bearings that, you know, spin the blood around and push the blood through the pump, and they're very durable, more than 5 years duration, 5 or 6 years, and again, then you probably have to do another surgery to change the pump. And if you just look at the X-ray, you can see it's still in the abdomen, but much smaller than the other pump. This patient is, again, one of my patients from Chicago. She was 19 years old. She had a postpartum cardiomyopathy, so she had a baby and then developed this heart failure afterwards, and she weighed 105 pounds. So you can imagine this pump going to somebody, it's 105 pounds, so much, much smaller, suddenly now became available to a much larger patient population. And finally, this is our jewel of the day, the third-generation pumps. This is really how small they are. They get implanted into the heart directly, and then you have a connector that goes into the big blood vessel of the heart. And if you look at the X-ray, but really the size is the same size as the defibrillator. So really very, very small pumps. Very, very good use, probably over 10 years, at least on the bench testing. They have 10 years of life. As everything else, there's complications. So, again, there's no free lunch for this either. But they're manageable. So some of the complications, infections, especially of the driveline, again, they all have this wire that comes out to connect the battery. So really patients have to be very carefully how they dress themselves and how they take care of that driveline. Bleeding, About 20% of the patients, especially if they had prior ulcers or colonic diverticuli, can bleed, you know, because all these pumps require blood thinners. They are, they're metal, so to speak. And then if you don't get blood thinners, they clot. So we have to put patients on blood thinners. Some patients can bleed. If you don't have a blood thinner or if your level is too low, patients can have a stroke. Fortunately, the device failure is very low. You know, it's about 5% or even less where the pump actually breaks. These are man-made products, so they can break, but fortunately, the breakage rate is very low. And then sometimes the right ventricle, so remember, these are pumps from the left side of the heart, and sometimes the right is very very dysfunctional, and then they do require either to put another pump on the right or do an artificial heart, completely artificial heart. But they do improve quality of life. These are data from the clinical trial. You can see everybody was red in the beginning, so class 4. And as they move forward over 3 and 6 months, everybody becomes green and blue, so class 2 and class 1. So most of these patients become, again, pretty normal after 3 to 6 months, and then go back to have a normal quality of life. Also, their functional capacity improves markedly. This is a six-minute walk test, so we ask patients to walk for 6 minutes and see how much they can walk. At baseline, everybody's around 200 meters, so that's about 600 feet. And then again, at about 6 months or so, they double that distance. So they do get stronger and able to exercise more. As I mentioned, the survival is pretty good. So the overall survival is about 80% at 1 year. This is our own survival for patients who are bridged to transplant. About 86% of the patients are alive or have been transplanted. So at UCSF, and I think it's very interesting. You know, we have a registry, a national registry, to look at these pumps and understand what complications and how many pumps have been implanted. So you can see an explosion really in the last 5 or 7 years because these pumps are becoming better and better. And in fact, if you look at last year, we've done more LVADs than transplants. Again, because the transplants are such a scarce resource, and LVADs, we just take them off the shelves. So a lot of the patients, even bridged to transplant now, live 3, 4, 5 years on the pump waiting for a transplant, but having pretty normal quality of life. And I think the future is bright. We have smaller and smaller LVADs, and then soon we'll have actually fully implantable LVADs, so we don't have to have the connection outside the body, and patients can really become fully independent. And I think my personal prediction that in 10 years we'll actually see a fully implantable LVAD that will be miniaturized, implanted with a small surgery, and then we'll have probably at least 10 years of life, and then we'll have a cost that's actually affordable for majority of patients. So thank you for your attention, and I'd like to invite one of our patients, Alex, who has gone through all the stages of heart failure, and he actually has an LVAD. So he can actually tell from his perspective how he feels and how he is doing with the LVAD.
I had been experiencing problems for about 4 to 5 years with, you know, heart failure and being handled at a much reduced level of medication and things like that. And then it just became more and more pronounced, where I had to seek, you know, a more high-end care. I was at, in 2012, the end of 2012, or 2013, I was in at Cal Pacific, and they encouraged me to consider the LVAD as an alternative. And when I finally did, they turned me down for it. They said that they didn't think my heart could take this, you know, the surgery, and basically told me to go home. Not the main doctor, but one of the doctors there said I'd be dead in a month. Well, then they turned me down for it, so I went home, didn't die. It was a struggle every day sometimes, but I was still going to work. I was still going to the, you know, gym when I felt up to it. And then one of the doctors at Cal Pacific put me in touch with Dr. Klein and said they would consider taking a peek at me. And I got, you know, accepted into the program for the LVAD with hopefully a transition that this would be a bridge to a heart transplant. So I had the surgery done on October 20th. It was kind of a, you know, rehabbing in the winter is tough because it's cold outside. You don't feel like, you know, being out. But I managed through that, and actually got back on track. I was at work all day in San Ramon where I work. I go to the gym almost every day. I'm probably doing more than Dr. Klein would probably want, but overall, I've done pretty well. The folks here have been so nice. I mean, their LVAD team, the clinic people, everybody I've come in contact with, these fine doctors, I've all had contact with, and the surgeon, and I can't say anything nicer about it. Initially, you have the bag with you. It's like not a big deal anymore. I mean, most of the people that I come in contact with daily know what it is in my office and that sort of thing. When I go to the gym, I wear a very attractive fishing vest. So it's got all these inside pockets so that you can tuck the batteries in, and so you don't have the bag swinging around you. And then I put a hoodie over it or something, and everybody at the gym knows, what it is. And, they're all real encouraging, do you know anything more? Do you know you're going to get a heart? And I said, well, it doesn't kind of work that way. They think you're scheduling it, for a transplant. But in any event, I'm very encouraged by, how I've been feeling. My life is probably pretty close back to normal, almost. I took a couple trips post-surgery, but before I went on the transplant list, because it's about a six-month wait till you can go on the transplant list because they have to recover from this surgery. And I took one business trip. It went through TSA actually pretty well, considering you're carrying batteries and wires and everything else through. They could not have been nicer leaving Oakland and coming and then leaving San Diego to come back. Couldn't have been nicer. They were so gentle and they couldn't have been nicer. I can't say enough. And so that's, really what I've been doing. And you just have to sort of be careful. I've not had any infection. I had great personal support. I'm not married. I had very close friends. I have a roommate. But I had a friend that came down from Utah who was with me because they have to become fairly educated in the wire. It goes in your side. And you have to make sure that that's kept, the dressing, bandaging is kept clean and everything else. And, he really stepped in and stepped up, and he's back in Utah now, and he's just waiting for the call for, if and when the transplant becomes available, and he'll be back down, as will so many of my friends and so many of my family. You have no modesty after all of this. I mean, my female friends, my male friends, everybody's seen me naked in the worst shape, And you know what? I'm happy, that everybody's kicked in. I mean, from all parts of my life. I'm really... it's really been a good run for me, and I don't feel weird, like today I got a little bit of short of breath coming in, but it was because I come in from the East Bay and I was worried about being late and the bridge was bad. And then I parked in the parking lot and sprinted over. And then when I got here and it was cold when I got out of the car and then I got a little short of breath, but I'm fine. And, if I get home early enough, I might go to the gym, but I doubt it. But I do. I try to live a pretty normal life, and I was fairly active before all this. So that's kind of my thing. So,
All right, so I think now we'll open up questions from the audience for all four of us, basically.
It's a great question. So is there an age cutoff for heart transplant or ventricular assist devices? Obviously, for heart transplantation, we're limited with resources. We don't have enough hearts. So different centers have different age cutoffs. Our center's cutoff is 70 years. We always say it's really your how you look at 70. There's some young 70s and there's some old 50s. So in general, 70. For LVADs, we don't really have an age cutoff. I mean, we take it off the shelf, so it really depends what shape patients are in. The oldest patient that was implanted with LVAD was 86. It was done in San Diego, and he's 92 now, and he's still playing golf. So again, it really depends how you feel and what shape you're in.
So the question is that if there's any correlation between sudden death and taking the blue pill. Sildenafil or Viagra or Cialis, is that your question? So there's no association between taking the pill and sudden death. There's association between sudden death and heart failure, but not with the pill and sudden death.
Yeah, it's a it's a great question. So the question is, you know, if the pumps are adaptable to physiologic changes, so if you exercise, that, do they get, you know, better flow, more flow? And the answer is yes. You know, remember the pump is designed to support the left side of the heart. The way the pump feels, it's from the right side. So you still have your own right side of the heart that pumps the blood into the lungs and then back to the heart. So naturally, when you exercise, that part of the heart is still ramps up. So your flow that goes into the LVAD, you know, will be higher. So the LVAD can actually increase the cardiac output when you exercise and decrease when you sleep. So there are some variation, sometimes even up to 1 or 2 liters. The pump is designed to be able to pump 10 liters of blood per minute. Great. So the two questions, one is there an average age for receiving the pump, and then, how is it reimbursed? So I think the question about the pump, we have two types of patients. One is patients that we bridge to transplant. So obviously those patients are younger. I would say average age probably about 50, 55. And then we have older patients who are not transplant candidates because they could be 70 or 75. So the average age for that group is probably around 72, 73. In terms of reimbursement, they are reimbursed by private insurance and Medicare. So they are reimbursed.
So the question is whether thyroid disease has any correlation with heart failure. So yeah, so both low thyroid and high thyroid can both cause a type of heart failure as well too. So the thyroid has a lot of roles in the body for different regulations in the body, and if it's overactive or underactive, it can cause heart failure. And basically, if you're treating the if you supplement the thyroid, or if you reduce the thyroid levels, that can actually improve the heart failure.
Do you know what the number are that
you're looking for? So we have a TSH. So usually it depends on the reference lab or wherever lab you go to, but generally 5 is the number. And so if it's below that, that means basically that the patient is hyperthyroid and vice versa. Yeah.
So hypertension is, people focus mostly these days on the systolic blood pressure of 140. Is the number we really like to see it below. And when we're titrating medications, we usually like to bring it below 140. A real true normal blood pressure is more like below 120. So people who have systolic pressures between 120 and 140 are kind of in that pre-hypertensive range. And there are some people who argue you should start treating that and targeting it much earlier on before people become actually hypertensive. And then what was your question about in terms of beta blockers?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. So beta blockers, one of the medications we use for heart failure, does slow the heart rate down. And oftentimes a slow heart rate will be one of the limiting factors in terms of our ability to use it. So we like to get the heart rate down to like the 60s or so. But some patients will come in with heart rates in the 60s, and when you put them on some beta blocker, they dip down to the 50s or even lower, and sometimes they'll become symptomatic from that, meaning they're lightheaded or fatigued or just feel terribly. And then that'll tell us, hey, they're on too much beta blocker. You know, even though we'd love to have them on a high dose of it, they're just not going to tolerate it.
Right, so the question is related to skin cancer. I believe it was with heart transplantation. So the medications that are used for transplantation can increase the risk of skin cancer. And that's why patients need to go to a dermatologist usually every year, unless they have a pre-existing skin condition, then they go every 6 months. Correct. The medication actually can cause malignancies, solid tumors as well, but by far the skin cancer is the most common. So the risk of, breast cancer or colon cancer or lung cancer, it's fairly low. I would say maybe about 1% or so. For each of these subtypes, and the skin cancer is probably about 10 to 15%, so much, much higher.
Yeah, so early detection is always a double-edged sword. You don't want to over-scan people or, you know, start treating things that won't actually become disease later on. So, I wouldn't want to say, everybody needs an echocardiogram. What I would say is that everybody needs what we call primary prevention of cardiovascular disease. So it's really important that you get your blood pressure checked. It's important that you get your cholesterol checked. And there are specific guidelines for all these about exactly how often you should, depending on your age and risk factors. But controlling those kinds of things, like I was saying, sodium in the diet seems to be related to it. So there are a lot of things we can do, you know, not smoking, not letting ourselves get obese, treating sleep apnea, treating all the different risk factors, which you should be doing anyway, because all those factors can lead to other things, will prevent a lot of cases before they become problematic. I don't think we're ready to advocate, you know, doing, say, an echocardiogram or checking that BNP lab or something in just everybody. I think that would be a little bit overkill. Yeah.
So the question, sorry, it's ultrafiltration and the management of heart failure. So usually we try to relieve congestion. This is done in the hospital, and we do that by IV diuretics or IV medication to help patients pee out the extra fluid. And sometimes patients don't respond, and then... And you can use a technique called ultrafiltration, which basically is actually removing the fluid through it's almost like a dialysis machine, basically. And we do use that if patients aren't responding to traditional diuretics. So it's like one step short of, let's say, dialysis. But most times you're able to manage with using diuretics.
So the 40%, the question is how to reduce the 40% rate of infection in LVADs. Actually, the 40% was the first generation LVADs, where they were really, really big, and the cable that came out was like my thumb, really, really thick. The current generation, the infection rate is around 10 to 15%. The cables that are coming out are really like a phone line. Yeah, it's a really thin line, so much, much less chance of infection. Obviously, very good hygiene when you change the dressing is very important. Avoiding trauma. A lot of patients, you know, drop their battery and then obviously that pulls on the skin. And then hopefully in the next 5 years we'll have fully implantable LVADs and that will completely eliminate the infection. It's a great question. So what is the advantage of heart transplantation compared to LVADs? So I think the main advantage is we've been doing heart transplants for, you know, almost 30 years. And we have a lot of experience, and we have great survival to show. So, you know, our program here was started in 1989, and we still have patients transplanting since 1989. So the average survival is about, you know, 13, 14 years. We have been doing LVADs for, I would say, less than a decade, especially this newer type of LVAD. So we don't have the data yet to say, yes, with the LVAD you can survive 10 years with no complications. We're getting there. I think right now, if you compare the two, when we talk to patients, we can say with heart transplantation, we know for sure you'll survive longer, but there may be a different discussion in 5 years where we can say, I think we will be able to say you have a similar survival and without that much medications. That's the hope, and that's why the development in LVADs and becoming smaller and smaller. And again, it would be great to just take something off the shelf and be able to implant it and say, you know, see you in 10 years.
So the question is, what's the rates of heart failure in men versus women and postmenopausal? So it kind of depends on the type of heart failure. So we talked about the patients who have a stiff heart and then those who have a weak pumping heart. So patients who have a stiff heart or diastolic heart failure or HFpEF, however you want to call it, there's definitely an increased risk of having that in women compared to men. That's usually we see on elder women as well, too. Postmenopausal, there's not much of a correlation between the two.
So the question is the efficacy of coronary calcium scan for healthy adults that don't have any risk factors. I think it's very efficacious for people who own the scan, not for the patients. So joke aside, you know, the coronary calcium scan is actually a useful tool when somebody has what we call intermediate risk factors. So much of what we do in medicine, it's based on statistics. So we have populations of people that we followed, you know, for 30, 40, 50 years, and then we saw who developed a heart attack or heart failure. And probably everyone is familiar with the Framingham Heart Study, which is the longest study that follow people for development of heart disease. So based on the Framingham, we've learned a lot about what causes heart disease, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, smoking, inactivity, obesity. And if we put all those in equation, we can predict pretty much who will develop a heart attack, let's say. And there are people that are very low risk, meaning that there's, you know, less than 5% chance over the next 10 years they'll develop a heart attack. People that are very high risk, there's a 15% chance. obviously people that are very high risk, you're going to treat anyway, so there's no, you know, there's no need for an additional test. People that are low risk, you're not going to do anything different, just tell them to keep doing what they're doing and, you know, be it low risk. And there are people in between, and probably about 40% of the population is in between. So you have a choice saying, well, let's put you on some medication and then be on the medication for the rest of your life, especially cholesterol-lowering medication. And there are plus and minuses, right? So they have side effects. Or you can say, well, let's do another test to see maybe you're not as much as a risk as we think you are. And that's where the coronary calcium score is very very useful, in that intermediate risk population. If you do a calcium score and you have absolutely no calcium, that means you're at a very low risk and you do not have to start a cholesterol-lowering medication, for instance. If you have a high score, then you should start a cholesterol-lowering medication.
How I ended up this way? I think there were... No smoking. I was fairly healthy. I'm HIV positive as well. And I don't know if these doctors, but I had another cardiologist tell me that the virus can get into the heart muscle and cause some problems. I don't know if you folks have found any correlation in that, but one of my other doctors had examined that. I was always fairly healthy, but when it really started to come on, about a year and a half, two years ago, I stopped going to the gym. I just wasn't quite up to it. So I've really started going back after this situation. And I think, I can't remember, I think it was Dr. Selby had said that people, were you recommending the rehab? I have a friend who dragged me to the gym. By myself, I would have had the same thing. You know, I was afraid to walk in the gym and pick up anything. I was afraid I was just going to keel over. But you get over that fear. And I just don't have that anymore. So I've gotten back into it. My muscle tones come back. I was like over 200 pounds. I was, you know, fairly into working out and everything else. I'm not a kid. I'm 63. It's just, you know, it's just, I think I had some congenital issues. I had irregular heart beats from a very young kid. Preventricular contraction was diagnosed when I was in my teens. And, you know, I didn't really watch it until a few years ago, and when it's about maybe 8 or 10 years ago, when it started to, you know, become a problem. But so I'm back to it, you know, and I mean, like I said, you know, that's part of my life, so I've just kind of gotten back into it.
So the question is, the immunosuppression drugs, why do they damage the kidneys? We actually know, so one of the drugs that the patients have to take, Prograf or tacrolimus, produces vasoconstriction of the kidney arteries. So they sort of make the vessels smaller, and because of that, they reduce the blood flow in the kidneys. They can cause high blood pressure and then eventually some kidney dysfunction. And that's why we try to balance. We check the blood levels of this drug and then try to balance the level with the dysfunction. So it's a very thin rope, very thin line.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.